but certainly hope not.
Do you think, though, that traditional economic theory has sufficiently taken into account just what devastation both capitalist and socialist economies have wrought on the environment, and that there's been a failure to reassess notions like economic growth and economic progress, because those notions don't take into account the environmental cost that there might have been in terms of that growth and that progress?
Well, I must, I hope this wouldn't be taken as a commercial. I must send everybody back to read The Affluent Society, which I published, some 32 years ago, and which I argued, as many have argued since, that we must balance our interest and emphasis in economic growth, which I don't wholly deplore, with the effect of this on the environment, on the landscape. And I pictured in that book, as I have many times since, the affluence, even the frivolous character of much of our private expenditure, and the penury with which we deal with matters like protecting the countryside, making sure that urban development is consistent with civilized needs, and with obviously keeping down air pollution, keeping our streets clean. We are here in the United States, a nation of clean houses and filthy streets. We're also a nation of very expensive television programs and lousy schools. Television here being private, as you know. There is a difference between the affluence of our private consumption and the penury of our public consumption, including environment, which I take very seriously. But I don't think this is going greatly to be changed, certainly in the short run, by what's happening in Eastern Europe.
I wanted to ask, in terms of looking back over your work, you're somebody who's actually born before the Russian Revolution, and arguably you're seeing out the demise of socialism in Eastern Europe, and I wondered if you look back over your economic life, to what extent you feel that the concepts that you use have changed, and in particular the ways in which they might have been changed by the socialist experiment, if you like.
Well, I always felt that there was a certain convergent tendency in economic development. I so argued in another book, The New Industrial State, that socialism would, communism would make concessions to the market, and that the non-communist world would have to make concessions to the welfare state, to a greater social control of the environment, the socializing of health care, the public provision of low-cost housing, and that this reflected on both sides a movement to the center, what I call convergence. I must say that when I published that book, which was about 1967, the criticism was about equal, East and West. It was published in the Soviet Union, the book, and my convergence theory was criticized there, and it was strongly criticized in the United States. So I've concluded ever since that if you have enough criticism from opposite quarters, you must be right.
Can you say what you think history will say has been the contribution of Marxist economic thought?
Oh, Marx is a much too important a figure to be left to the socialists and the communists. And Marx had a vision of the problems, the inequities, the distortions, the exploitation of primitive capitalism that was very, very important in forcing and leading to the ameliorative mellowing changes which allowed it to survive. And I, for one, hope that people, students, scholars, will continue to read Marx. But he wrote, let us not forget, he wrote for the middle of the last century, and not for the closing years of the present century.
Do you think there's anything that we can say to countries who are looking enviously at the moment, you know, whether appropriately or not, over at the Western capitalist system? Is there any things that we can say in terms of avoid this, avoid that?
Oh, yes. And the broad rule, the broad lesson, on which I would strike a concluding note, the broad lesson of these last months should be clear to Americans, to Australians, to people everywhere. And that is a very clear, important matter. We must not be guided by ideology. We must not be guided by principles of capitalism, free enterprise. We must not be guided by principles of communism or socialism. We live in a world where those are escapes from thought. And we must take up and judge action, and particularly we must judge public action, each case on its merits. There are some cases where we must have government enterprise, government control. There's no place, for example, no country where the private capitalist system builds good low-cost houses. That has to be socialized, same way health care. On the other hand, when it comes to cosmetics, perfume, agriculture, many other consumer products, many capital goods products, I'm all in favor of the market. I want to examine policy in a pragmatic way and not in terms of primitive ideology.
Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Oh, this was a pleasure indeed. And do give my greetings to all my friends in Australia, will you?
You've been listening to John Kenneth Galbraith, Emeritus Professor of Economics at Harvard University. I'm Liz Jackson. Next week, Background Briefing goes to East Germany. In Deutschmark, Deutschmark, Über Alles, Tom Morton talks to East German students, workers and writers about how they see their changing society.
How do you think, though, you're going to be affected by the beginnings of a market economy in East Germany?
Yeah, we are a bit pessimistic and skeptical about this. There have been made promises from the West German government that the drawbacks for us should not be too big. And I think if once again we had to pay much more for this, it would be very unfair.
That's Background Briefing, next week in East Germany.
Kashmir's most serious problem which India has faced after independence.
This week on Indian Pacific, leading journalist Masi Raman of the magazine India Today talks about Kashmir.
The people of Kashmir have always been distrustful of the authority in Delhi, and it's as if the entire Kashmir population has risen in protest against the Indian government's authority there.
Kashmir on Indian Pacific this week.
Today on Background Briefing, we're discussing capitalism, communism, and the collapse of socialism in Eastern Europe with Professor John Kenneth Galbraith. Galbraith has long been one of the most original, provocative, and certainly best-known economists of our time. He's now 81. Throughout his life, he's remained a keen critic of economic policy that's dictated by ideology rather than pragmatism, be that ideology of the left or the right. Galbraith's early critiques of American capitalism have become economic classics. In his best-known work, The Affluent Society, published in 1958, Galbraith summed up the failings of the free market in the now famous phrase, private affluence and public squalor. The Affluent Society was translated into over a dozen languages and established Galbraith's reputation as one of the wittiest and most accessible of economic writers. Although he styles himself an independent operator at the guerrilla level of American politics, Galbraith was involved with the Democratic Party for many years and was an economic policy advisor to John F. Kennedy. He was an influential part of the school of thought that led to a significant expansion of social welfare programs in both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. In his more recent books, such as Communism, Capitalism and Coexistence, published in 1988, Galbraith has been concerned to argue that capitalism and socialism cannot and have not remained bipolar opposites, that both economic models have made concessions to the successful features of both systems. In the present climate, of course, there are few people, let alone economists, with much to say about the successes of socialism or the failings of the free market. The economic conclusions drawn from events in Eastern Europe have tended to the simplistic socialism is dead and free market capitalism vindicated. Earlier this year, after his most recent trip to Eastern Europe, Galbraith summed up this tendency as the triumph of simplistic ideology. I contacted Professor Galbraith at Harvard University, where he's still the emeritus professor of economics, to ask what he meant by that.
Well, I'm very happy to respond on that. I've been giving it a lot of thought. I've also been recent times been in Budapest and Leipzig, and there is an aspect of the talk which is not very satisfactory, which pictures this as a rigidly bipolar situation as between capitalism on the one hand and communism, sometimes better perhaps called socialism, on the other hand, and which doesn't take into account the enormous concessions which capitalism has had to make in order for its own survival. Let us examine for a moment the capitalist model under which Australians and Americans and Western Europeans, Japanese, function. If this were the classical capitalist model, that of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, and that of the last century, nobody much east or west would want it. This was a model that reposed enormous power in the hands of the owners of the means of production, gave little or no power to workers, was very cruel to women and children. It discarded the aged, old, when they could no longer work, if they survived, and was given to enormously violent fluctuations, culminating in the Great Depression of the 1930s. And this model of capitalism, this classical model, would not have survived. It bred anger, alienation, and attitudes of revolt. But fortunately, this was a system which under pressure of popular opinion, public opinion, could adapt, couldn't it? And so one got the welfare state, Social Security, unemployment compensation, protection to women and children, support to farm prices, and efforts, still imperfect in their execution, at smoothing out the business cycle, ensuring something approaching full employment, something approaching, but still better for the effort. And this is the model, not classical capitalism, that the people in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union have seen. But someone has said that in economics, as in religion, the convert is more converted than the person who is accustomed to the particular faith. And there's no question that both East and West, there is an image of a move to capitalism and to a kind of capitalism which Americans, Australians, Western Europeans, Japanese wouldn't tolerate. You follow me?
I do. I mean, is that your experience, that the people, the economists that you've talked to in Eastern Europe, have an enthusiasm for an unfettered kind of free market that simply isn't what we have here?
Well, no. The economists that I talk with are more moderate in mood. And this has been particularly true of the ones I've talked with in Hungary, also in East Germany. But there is a wing of opinion which holds in a rather simplistic fashion that here is a model of communism, here is a model of capitalism, and we make the transition from one model to the other, even at the cost of some considerable pain, but with the assurance that the new model will be workable.
Where do you see that simplistic interpretation coming from, then, and what do you see as the dangers of that simplification?
Oh, some of it has been flowing out of Washington to European countries. A model that is part of the image of Reagan economics, and which Mr. Reagan was wise enough not to shove through. If he had pressed for the abandonment of old age pensions, unemployment compensation, he would have been out of office at the end of his first term. But that rhetoric, that still comes from some parts of the United States and some individuals in the United States. And as I say, it strikes a certain extremist mood in Eastern Europe. I'll give you an example. When I was lecturing last autumn in Budapest, I had a press conference after my lecture, and one reporter was very insistent, very critical of me, because I had not spoken favorably as an alternative to the socialist system. I had not spoken favorably of the work of Friedrich von Hayek. And he was quite shocked when I said that the economics of Professor Hayek was something that we wouldn't care to risk in the United States.
Could you just say, for people who don't know, just what Professor Hayek's economics represent in terms of economic models?
Oh, I'm sure all Australians know about Professor Hayek, but or Professor Friedman. But this is an extreme free market system. No welfare state, no social security, no support to farm prices, at least a minimum support to the poor. Professor Hayek is most famous for a book called The Road to Serfdom, and that is a book which came out after World War II, criticizing the whole movement of the New Deal in the United States and the whole movement of Keynesian economics as a menace to liberty. I think it's fair to say of Professor Hayek that he never came to the obvious conclusion that to be totally without money is probably one of the worst infringements of liberty that a person can suffer.
I wanted to ask how much you felt that the collapse and rejection of the Eastern European government came from the economic failure of the socialist systems there.
This is a most interesting question and a most important one. And it's not simple. In the first days, the first years, the first decades of socialism in the Soviet Union, and I think it's fair to say in Eastern Europe as well, it was not unwelcome. It didn't work badly. In the Soviet Union, after all, it built the second greatest industrial system in the world after the United States. And in there and in Eastern Europe, it liquidated the remnants of feudalism, and initially, at least in Russia, gave land to the people, although Stalin later took it away. And this whole development was, as I say, not unsuccessful. And it mobilized the armies and the weapons that threw back Hitler. And we must always remember, saved a certain number of American and Australian lives. But the system began to fail at a later stage. Possibly we can think of the last 10 or 15 years. It failed first because it created an enormously large and, on the whole, ineffective, sclerotic bureaucracy. By some counts, the bureaucracy of the Soviet Union has somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 million inhabitants. And that was, like all great bureaucratic establishments, including, I may say, our own Pentagon, given to protecting its own status and wasn't accommodating to change. And the change was extremely important because after this basic structure of the economic system was established, the steel mills, the electrical power generating plants, the chemical factories and the oil recovery industry, after that was established, and to which the planning and command system of socialism lent itself very well. After that was accomplished came consumers' goods. And here one has enormous numbers of styles, designs, changing consumer wants, and for this, the planning and command structure of socialism, communism, did not work. And it simply wasn't up to the task there. Coupled with another thing, which is also very important, socialism has never worked very well for agriculture. Agriculture works best and perhaps only when the individual enterprise is under the command of the proprietor. And where, in some measure, it works by the exploitation of the individual of himself and his family. And the state farms, they simply didn't produce food efficiently. This was particularly true in the Soviet Union. So what one had was a changing situation in which the changing requirements imposed tasks which the original socialism could not perform. And there's no question that that was a source of dissatisfaction, particularly when people in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union compared their situation and their supply of consumer goods with what was so visible in Western Europe, the United States. There was another factor here which is also important to emphasize. As an economy develops, you get a very large number of people, professors, students, journalists, television commentators, business managers, would-be politicians, an enormous number of people who simply can't be kept quiet. If you have a dispersed peasant population, as was true in the last century, working from morning till night to keep alive, there's no problem of suppressing free speech. People don't aggressively demand it in a great many cases. But in the modern economy, you have more people than can be kept quiet, more people seeking voice, and more people seeking participation in the government than can be suppressed. And this is true not only under capitalist development, but it is true under socialist development. So that by last year, when the great explosion came, you had an enormous number of people in Eastern Europe who simply could not be kept quiet any longer.
You've talked about the problems of socialism as an economic system in terms of its failure to respond to changing economic circumstances. I'm interested that you've not talked so much about the failure in terms of socialism not sufficiently rewarding individual enterprise, initiative, not acknowledging, I suppose, the necessity of people to pursue profit.
Oh, I agree with all that. That socialism unquestionably had an unduly favorable image of human beings. And I think the sad truth is that people work best and work together best when they enjoy their own reward. And a number of people who are willing to submit to broad social discipline for what is deemed to be the good of the country is indeed limited. And I think this is something that has certainly been demonstrated. And the point you make is a very good one.
You do think that it's one of those depressing conclusions that we might draw from this, is that it's hard to motivate individuals for the public good. It's much easier to motivate individuals for the individual good.
I would certainly agree with that, yes. I think one has to live with human nature as it is. That has been my experience. But I don't think that is the central matter. We have a lot of people, West and East, who will commit themselves to the public good. Recent elections in Australia involved a lot of people who could have made much more money, had much larger earnings outside of politics, but who have some image of public achievement, public service. So we can't deny that motivation. But I think in economic matters, it is true that one gets the most out of an economy if one rewards people in accordance with their effort. That Marx's most famous words, which were from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, reflected a better mood than has come to exist.
I wanted to talk about Australia briefly here, actually, which is to ask you how relevant you think it is for countries like Australia to actually draw any kind of parallels with what's happening in Eastern Europe. And I ask that because you find here politicians of a conservative nature saying, look over there, that should show us that we should go for a more deregulated economy, that we should encourage privatisation, as if somehow we should be learning that in the Eastern Bloc.
I hope
Do you think that's an apt lesson?
I'm an admirer of Australia, and I hope you don't have too many of those people. We have some here, too. But the actual lesson is that both East and West, we must find a middle ground. That there, as I've indicated, some things which the market, some things which self-motivated enterprise alone can accomplish. And that is true over the great span of economic activity. But let us not forget that there are a great many things, trade unions, social security, which I've mentioned, a broad policy of supporting employment, a broad policy of supporting agriculture, many other things which we must have from the state, and which people of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union have been seeing as part of the model that they want to pursue. Some extremists, the extremists that I've mentioned, aside.
You're listening to Professor John Kenneth Galbraith talking on Background Briefing. It seems from the recent elections in both East Germany and in Hungary that people are voting for those governments that are offering them the quickest transition to the freest market. Do you have any concerns about what that will involve for the people who live in those countries, making that quick transition, as I say, to the free market?
Yes, I have. I have a real concern. Let us, first of all, be clear on one point. That we've had many movements modifying old-fashioned classical capitalism, and in the common expression, moving to the left, moving to the welfare state, moving to social democracy. This is commonplace. All industrial countries have made a greater or less move in that direction. We have no experience in the world with moving from a complete socialist, a complete communist state, back to the free market, or back to capitalism, or back to the middle-of-the-road structure, which I would certainly urge. And so we don't know how difficult that is going to be. There are a great many people who are talking very vividly, very confidently about this move, and I think they divide into two classes, those who don't know and those who don't really know they don't know. So we must be very cautious in talking about this transition. And I think that it could be much slower than some people imagine, and it could be somewhat more painful than some people are thinking.
If you were advising those countries, though, I mean, would you advise the sort of short, sharp shock transition, what I believe is called cold shower capitalism, or would you advise a much steadier, slower pace in terms of opening up the market to foreign investment and putting currencies onto the international hard currency circuit? Would you advise those things to be done slowly, or, as I say, the sort of go for it all at once approach?
Oh, I would have no doubt I would proceed slowly. There is a line of thought which says, in effect, this must be done very quickly, and that there is some merit in the pain that would be required, the reduction in living standards, unemployment, that this will have a therapeutic effect. I would avoid that. If I were giving advice, God forbid, I would urge a much more thoughtful, pragmatic move, and not expect to accomplish this transition in one fell swoop. And I think, in fact, that is what's going to happen. This is not going to be a sudden therapeutic rush to undo all of the functions of government. And there are other things where, if I were giving advice, I would persuade them to go slow. In all of these countries, there's been an enormous amount of housing built in these last decades. And this is available to people at a very low price. And if I were guiding things in those countries, I would be reluctant to let rents go back up to market levels. I think this would be quite impossible. So that I would conclude that in the end, there is going to be a gradualism, and that the people who are talking about shock therapy, a word that has crept into the language, well, they're urging something that isn't going to happen.
What do you think the obligations of the West, and in particular the United States, are in this transition period? I mean, should we be giving more than advice? Or should we be giving aid? Or?
I'm not enthusiastic about the advice. In the case of the Bush administration in the United States, there's a great preference for advice as distinct from hard cash. Mr. Bush last year made a trip to Poland and Hungary and congratulated them deeply on the changes that were underway and then left a small tip. I'm very much opposed to speeches and advice as a substitute for hard cash. These countries are undergoing, as we have just said, a period of enormous change. And there's a possibility of very great hardship in connection with this change. And it would surely be one of the misfortunes of the world if liberalization and freedom of speech and democratic government were associated with severe hardship. Hardship so severe that people would say, well, the old system wasn't good, but it was better. And to that end, I have been a strong advocate, with many others, of loans and grants, both from the United States, the Western European countries, other countries, as well as from the international agencies, to help ease this transition. And I would like to see that in good volume. I, along with a good many others, I wish very much we had the imagination to have something now like the Marshall Plan. At that time, it was at that period of transition, this was a very important step. And I wish very much with the, not by the United States alone, but Western Europe, Japan, Australia, Canada, there would be a unified effort to ease this transition, mostly in respect of consumers' goods, including food. It is there, as I said earlier, that the system failed. And it is these things which are most in demand. And these things I would like to see in reasonably ample supply in Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and in the Soviet Union in the weeks and months to come. I don't mention East Germany because I think East Germany is going to be helped in very substantial measure by West Germany, and it's possibly the easiest case. I should add Czechoslovakia, however. This is a country which will make this transition with good sense and discipline, but is also deserving of help.
But has the United States got the money to give substantial amounts of aid?
Oh, we have the money to subsidize an unnecessary, a bloated military establishment. Certainly, we could extract some money from the stealth bombers and the Star Wars to this end. They chew up billions. And, as I say, this I would like to see a united effort bringing in Western Europe, Japan, and extending down to the Antipodes.
I understand that President Bush, though, is taking a different track in terms of what kind of assistance to give to the Eastern Bloc, and is looking more to big business, I suppose, rather than looking to aid. Do you have any concerns about that idea that it should be business that actually moves in and provides the foreign capital to these countries?
Well, I prefer President Bush's economics to that of his predecessor, but it has a strong tendency, unfortunately, emphasize anything that doesn't cost money, and particularly anything that doesn't involve an increase in taxes. And so, among other things, there comes conversation about joint ventures, investment by American and by Western and Japanese corporations in the Soviet Union. Well, I certainly favor that, but I do not think this is going to have a transforming, a major role. I think that most corporations are going to move rather cautiously. I don't see General Motors getting into the business of manufacturing automobiles in the Soviet Union. I may be wrong. There might be some spark of imagination out there in Detroit that I don't see. But I think we're likely to have more conversation along these lines than we are to have the reality of change. But I would like to see as much as possible, certainly.
Do you think, though, there's any questions that it would raise in terms of if an awful lot of foreign investment goes into those countries? Do you think it raises any sort of question about the economic sovereignty of those countries? If their telephones are run by foreign companies, if their transport system is run by foreign companies, etc., etc.?
Oh, certainly not. As a matter of fact, we've had a considerable purchase of American corporations by the Japanese in these last years. And while there's been some discomfort about that, I haven't noticed that we have been falling under Japanese influence. I was born and reared in Canada, and I always thought the Canadian government had more power when it came to dealing with the branch plants of American corporations, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, than it did in dealing with the Canadian Pacific Railway, a Native American corporation. I have never joined some of my liberal friends in worrying about the imperialism of the great transnational corporations.
Do you think there's any question in terms of the price they might have to pay to attract that capital if they're competing with third world countries in terms of having to keep labor costs down, in terms of having to keep a fairly deregulated system in terms of environmental protection, the kind of things that they'll have to do in terms of, as I say, attracting that capital in competition with the third world?
I think we're all going to have to give more attention to the environment than we have, and this is certainly true here in the United States. When we have an environmental concern, as for example acid rain, pollution of the Great Lakes, we have a strong tendency to initiate another study as a substitute for action. And I share the concern of my scientific friends over what we're doing to the atmosphere, what we're doing to the ozone layer. But I don't see anything in this new development in Eastern Europe that is going deeply to influence environmental concerns.